Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Mike Bradner of the Alaska Legislative Digest, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The Alaska First Coalition, funded in good measure by the AFL-CIO, has been spending serious money in support of the current Senate coalition in Juneau and the current oil tax regime. Paul, tell us more.
Well, I think as most Alaskans know, the Senate broke up 10-10 a few years ago, and they had a 10 Democrat, 6 Republican coalition form. And that coalition has been instrumental in blocking reform of the Alaska's
clear and equitable.
We'll hear about that later. He's just already over there fuming. Actually, fixes to the progressive nature of the tax. State economists have said in the past it takes anywhere from $1.5 to $2 billion too much out of the oil industry shareholders' pockets. But the labor union and the left want to hang on to that money. It contributes to fat capital budgets and increased government spending and increased government program. So they want to hang on to it. And this is the offshoot of that. They've gathered up, I guess, $284,000 over the past quarter of the past reporting period. It's not only the AFL-CIO, it's the IBEW, and it's the NEA Alaska PACE. It's all of those. The idea is money to the state is good for them, and they're fighting to keep it. The coalition so far has lost 2 Republican members who were booted out at the primary. By Republican voters who are angry about this coalition, apparently. And it remains to be seen how it'll shake out, but they're gathering and spending money like crazy trying to maintain the coalition.
Let's get to Mike Bradner and his perspective. What do you make of this?
Well, I think the group is effective in what they're doing, because if there wasn't such a group filling that kind of void, you would certainly feel the void and it would certainly reduce the debate. So how effective they're being, I don't think is the question. They're there, they're facilitating the discussion. Whether this is necessary to sort of line the pockets of the stockholders of the oil companies, I don't know, because oil prices have gone up much higher than any of us expected at that time and just before. And that's good news for both sides. So I don't know whether this is as important as people think. It was slow in coming about. I mean, it took a while for Governor Parnell to come on board. And then it had a contentious, you know.
Let me ask you this. The AFL-CIO and the labor unions and others are spending this money in support of the coalition. When the campaign started, or in the spring, there was a widespread belief that the oil companies were just going to spend all kinds of money through PACs and independent expenditures to defeat some of these coalition people, but it doesn't seem to have happened.
Well, I think that's hard for them to do. They've always relied on their contractors and support groups and this type of things, which have stepped forward early on, and we did have...
Through campaign contributions to individual candidates.
To individuals. I mean, for instance, Randy Rudrick, if he wishes, he doesn't have to take money into the Republican Party. He can sort of direct people to go straight to those people. And you do see the same names cropping up all the way down the reports, including migrated into Fairbanks. Now, I think in a way that's energized the other side. I mean, it's hard to figure out what...
You mean the pro-coalition people?
That's right. Well, not so much pro-coalition, but they just saw this group affiliated with the oil companies and trying to go after specific senators. And, I mean, for some reason, I think that enabled labor union members to reach their members, because their members are actually pretty conservative. The union has sort of a particular philosophical orientation, but that's not necessarily the voters of their unions. I mean, and painfully so. But
Paul, you want to add anything here before we move on?
No, we can move on.
Okay. Dermot Cole, you take issue with the word reform in a recent column. You say that it's been misused over and over and over again in the oil tax debate and cite a lot of examples. In fact, what got your attention and drew your criticism, your ire, as it were?
Well, I'm not sure it was my ire, Mike, as much as my, I'm kind of just fed up with hearing people talk about oil tax reform when they what they really mean is an oil tax reduction. And to be clear about this debate, that's what it involves. Reform is a nice neutral sounding word that no one objects to. And likewise, as Mr. Jenkins just used the word fixes, well, people don't mind fixing things, even though they might disagree on what those fixes are.
You abused the word meaningful too, didn't you? You weren't a fan of the word meaningful as in meaningful reform.
Yeah, I'm not. Unfortunately, I think that doesn't contribute anything to the meaningful discussion that we need. The meaningful reform, I have no idea what that means. I have no clue what meaningful reform is. So let's just talk about a large reduction. That's what meaningful reform is, a large reduction in oil taxes. I think we would just be better served if we were more precise in the terms we used to describe this. I think what's really been missing, it's still missing, is a discussion and a debate that goes into detail on what's, what level of taxation is needed to produce the result that we want. And really, I think all of it's been is an advertising campaign based on a simplistic look at the situation with, visions of North Dakota brought up before us.
Well,
I think people, reporters and editors and columnists haven't done enough work on this, haven't done the work on it, frankly.
Well, haven't the governor and many of the Republican candidates come forward and say, yes, we're going to reduce the taxes on the oil companies. We believe this is the right thing to do because while we'll lose the number of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars annually, we'll make it all back up in people going to work in the oil patch. We've had people on our show that have, on running, that have said just that.
But they don't say how much time that takes.
Dermot, let's get you back.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it was Mike just said that. But I think that's correct. I mean, they don't say how long that will take. It's years and years. I mean, there's no real clear cause and effect relationship here, at least not a direct one. There is an indirect relationship. We need a better discussion of this. And Paul was mentioned earlier about how the people who support the oil tax like hefty capital budgets. Well, they're not the only ones who like hefty capital budgets.
I do too.
Conservative Republicans like hefty capital budgets as well. And, the issue with the oil tax coming up now is any quote, meaningful oil tax reduction is going to put us in a year-to-year deficit situation almost immediately. So that's going to be hard for people to defend unless there is a substantial cut in the capital budget. Okay. Anyway, Mike, just one more thing on this. I think the key thing is to justify the numbers. You want to justify the numbers of what they are now or justify the numbers of what the proposed cuts are.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go back to Mike Bredner. Mike, last week we visited the Senate race involving Bob Bell and Hollis French, and we were particularly interested in Bob Bell's APOC report and the fact that his firm had $1 million contract with one oil company, BP. You have been the Speaker of the House as well as a journalist, and you have perspective as most of us don't have. What would this mean for Bell as a legislator? I mean, we've heard the argument that fishermen, represent their industry and make money from fish companies, but this seems like an exceptionally large amount of money.
That's right, and it puts your best interest against the state's best interest. And it gets more complicated than that because you have people working in your firm who are depending on that particular income and those contracts. It's one thing for an individual to say, I don't care if, the oil company or the contract walks away, but when it rests on somebody else's shoulders, it takes them out too. That's really difficult. But I think it reflects that years ago it would have been different. And I think what's happened, the more we craft ethics law, the more politicians feel like as long as they're technically legal, it's okay. Not not the principle of what's there, but they're technically legal. And years ago, that's one reason why legislatures back during my time put in place that you had to vote with, unless you got permission of the whole body, because you'd watch people lobby something all the way through the legislature, and then they would stand up and sort of cleanse themselves, you know, sort of take a shower in public by abstaining. And that was a meaningful vote. And plus, you had the issue, it belongs to your constituency, really, the vote.
Yeah, and you're depriving your constituents,
right,
if you don't vote.
And I think it's a public issue. You know, it's not something you're going to solve in the matter of the law. It's fair game, and the public ought to be concerned
about,
that's right, how many conflicts you have.
Well, we should note here, and if I misspoke, Mr. Bell's firm received this,
yes,
this money, not him personally, and he points out that distinction.
I think that makes it worse, because because then you have other people, you know, who depend on a vendetta that you may inherit. I
mean, let me ask you this. In your days as Speaker, as a member of the legislature, do you remember other legislators who were similarly situated, where they had large contracts, or they were, we have members of the, you know, legislature now who are employees of the oil companies?
Well, we do. And we had a few back then, too. We had a Representative Fink, not Tom Fink, who worked for ARCO. But I'm not sure what his particular position was. We currently have a member of the legislature who works for ConocoPhillips. And I think it depends on the nature of the job. But I remember one occasion where the majority leader back then suddenly woke up and realized that he had some worthless land out along the Tanana River, and suddenly there was going to be a spur put through to the International Airport. The state was going to donate the gravel, the railroad, the rails, and this was during the pipeline period. And he was in a panic, because he said, I got these lots, you know, in a legal settlement. And he hastened to, make a revelation, because he was concerned that people would criticize him.
Dermot, let's go to you. What do you see here, and then we'll go to Paul.
Well, I think I may have this wrong, but I think maybe it was right after Mike was Speaker of the House that Larry Carpenter from Fairbanks was in the state legislature, and at the time he was the spokesman in Fairbanks for Alyeska Pipeline Service Company during the construction of the pipeline. And we've had many legislators over the years, not just from our area, but from other areas, that have been very closely tied to one industry or another. I don't know if it makes that much difference. If you get a lobbying contract, or not a lobbying, but perhaps a lobbying contract is somewhat different. But there are many employees who have, you know, gone to the legislature and then carried out their duty in a way that sort of benefits their employer. I think that's common. It's really hard to draw specific lines on what's acceptable, I think.
Let's go to Mike for one more thing, and then I do want to get Paul in the discussion. Mike, it's been argued many times that, hey, this is a citizen legislature. People have to have jobs. They have to work. Their money comes from somewhere, and they're inevitably going to pay attention to where their bread is buttered.
That's absolutely true, and plus we're a small state where the structures are small, and you're going to come up with a lot of people serving who have, it depends on the politics of the time. I mean, you may have some potential conflicts in the fishery area, but it doesn't happen to be a period where those things are of concern. And that's where I think it has to be an issue of the voter, because if they look up and their legislator keeps coming up with conflicts, then I think it's fair game for somebody to criticize, and I think that's the way it needs to be done, that you have a conflict, and you should think about not being there.
And if I remember this correctly from my youth, from your youth, weren't most of the questions raised about people's fishing interests? The only oil industry was in South Central Alaska. There was nobody from Fairbanks who really knew anything about it.
That was correct, except, our friendly little non-competitive leaseholders.
We're
mostly from Fairbanks.
That's right. The guys who had leases on the North Slope, yeah, when you went into the legislature. Okay, Paul, we've kept you out of the discussion on purpose, but we've had these other gentlemen.
Right.
What would you like to add here?
We do have a citizen legislature. We have to expect that everybody there should have a job outside the legislature. What Alaska doesn't need is more professional politicians. If a guy's got a job or a woman has a job or a shareholder or a company or something outside the legislature, do we just do it on a thing of magnitude? Oh, it's $1 million, so that's terrible. Oh, he's got a little flower stand, so that's okay. None of it's okay if it's not declared. It all has to be declared. In this particular case, this thing has kind of been turned to BP as the enemy. He's doing business with the enemy. $1 million. Oh, my God, he's a crook. Now, the implication clearly is that he has a conflict, even though it's been declared. Everybody knows about it. To me, I mean, open declaration of all of this stuff up front with a stronger, more active APOC, and I think we get someplace. But just saying, well, to paraphrase, if you got this conflict, you probably shouldn't be there. They all should have conflict. We need businessmen there who've got some expertise in how numbers work, rather than lawyers or professional politicians.
That's the public's jury.
Exactly. It's the way it should be. It's their vote we're talking about.
Okay, Paul, let's stick with you. Superior Court Judge John Suttuck upheld the parental notification law the legislature passed. This has been a matter of serious contention for some time now. What did the judge say, and what's next?
In 2007, the Supreme Court struck down a law that required notification and permission from the parent. So for 3 years, there was nothing. In 2010, an initiative process, the state of Alaska, hotly contested, Maurice, by the way, we adopted the parental notification law. Judge Suttuck has said that, yes, it's constitutional. It does not violate privacy concerns or due process rights. And a controversial part of that ruling, he said doctors can be criminally prosecuted if, in fact, they perform operations on girls who haven't notified their, whose parents haven't been notified. So all in all, it's quite a divergence from where we've been, and it'll go to the Supreme Court at least twice before this is done. As in everything else in Alaska, it'll be settled by those guys.
Okay, let's return to Dermot Cole in Fairbanks. Dermot, Fairbanks held municipal elections recently. They hold their elections in the fall, unlike Anchorage. Give us the full report of the Fairbanks municipal elections.
Mike, Luke Hopkins was reelected as mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And among the more noteworthy other results of the election was the approval of a proposition that came forth from a citizens campaign to prevent the borough from in any way limiting the use of wood stoves or any type of wood stoves or fuel burning devices. This relates to the ongoing pollution control issues in Fairbanks. Maybe the result of that vote is that this will now be in state hands instead of borough hands, at least in terms of pollution violations related to air pollution. The borough assembly vote here, basically, there were three seats up for grabs, and the results would leave the assembly in about the same position philosophically as it has been for the past couple of years. And
which
finally,
is what?
What
is the philosophy of the assembly, basically?
Well, it's about some of this and some of that. It's really close to a 50-50 split. With Diane Hutchison, who is sort of a conservative and moderate voice in the middle, and she's often the key vote between these two factions. And I just might finally add that at North Pole, a young man named Bryce Ward was elected mayor, and I think this is the first elected official that I've known since he was 11 years old, which tells you about something about how long I've been following these things. He was in my son's Boy Scout troop, and so I went on many camping trips with him when he was a kid. But he'll do well. He's a kind of bright, promising future of North Pole.
Okay, that's great to hear. Mike, the big three oil companies reported to Governor Parnell on the progress of the gas line. There was memos flying and press conferences. The company sent the governor this formal letter updating their view of the project. What did you make of the letter, and what are the implications for oil taxes?
I think the letter was a little softer than what he wanted. Because when he sort of set up his great alignment, he did so with a posture of sort of kicking the companies around a little bit, the Port Thompson leases. And as I read between the lines, it seemed more like you were pointing Point Thompson gas to possibly be reinjected in the Prudhoe Bay field and drive more oil. But that being as it may, I think it complicates the oil tax issue, because now there's going to be leverage to try to create oil and gas tax certainty. And that's a lot different. That takes you back to where the Murkowski plan was, when suddenly somebody said, we're going to freeze taxes for 45 years. Now, how exactly Parnell and the industry handled that? And on one side, certainty isn't so important in the oil arena. But I think anybody who works with natural gas and utilities knows that these are contractual arrangements, and your person you're contracting with you doesn't like open ends that can allow third parties to act. So it's a real problem and a lot of political problem, and it's going to come to roost next session.
Paul, your reaction to Mike's analysis?
I think he's exactly right. I thought it was probably nowhere near what the Parnell administration had been hoping for. They kind of said, well, yeah, we're doing some stuff, and we got some people working on it, and, you know, we'll let you know. And so, essentially, when you start talking about the tax certainty and that sort of thing, that's the same thing that's been the bugaboo since day one. And the state cannot somehow bring itself to get around this problem of legislatures making subsequent legislators beholden. They can't get by that, and they kind of flounder and founder, and they don't get anything done. But that's going to have to be resolved.
Let's get Dermot Cole in here first. Dermot, you wrote a column on this. For those who missed your column down here in South Central Alaska, tell us what you said.
Well, I thought the letter was really underwhelming, to tell you the truth. But I agree with both Paul and Mike about this point of oil taxes. One of the things the letter says is that the state needs a good, I'm paraphrasing now, but it needs a healthy oil tax situation before they can move ahead with the gas pipeline. Now, that is really going to complicate this whole debate. So you not only have the oil tax situation, but as Mike and Paul just referred to, the concept of freezing gas taxes. I'm not sure how this is all going to be sorted out. And I don't believe that the oil companies have provided a clear timeline. There's just too many unknowns at this point.
Mike, briefly.
The price seemed overwhelming. I mean, it was real sticker shock at $69 million or billion dollars. And we also got to be cognizant that we have to pay a 800-mile pipeline premium just to get to water's edge. So we shouldn't be deluded that this is much more than an idea, that we're taking a good fresh look at this point.
Okay, let's go back to Dermot Cole. Dermot, local governments in Fairbanks is very concerned about the rising cost of energy and what it might mean to the future of the community. And the North Star Borough is wants to create a borough public utility to obtain and deliver gas to homes and businesses. Explain what's happening.
Okay, this is driven largely, Mike, by the huge energy differential between Fairbanks and Anchorage in the lower 48. With the natural gas situation today, natural gas prices throughout the U.S. are dropping, and there's still a relative bargain in Anchorage. In Fairbanks, by and large, we're paying three times as much for space heating as in Anchorage. Because of that, there's been a kind of a community focus on getting natural gas as a fuel into Fairbanks. That's what I see in this drive to create a borough utility, which was approved this week by the Fairbanks City Council and the North Star Borough Assembly. The details of it are yet to be worked out, but it's sort of a first organized government effort to get natural gas here in many decades.
Well, isn't implicit in this the recognition or the argument that the market is failing and that the government has to intervene here?
That's part of the argument, and that's basically correct. I mean, there is a small natural gas utility in Fairbanks that serves about 460 homes and about 600 other enterprises, businesses and nonprofits and that sort of thing. But that's a very small, and there are tens of thousands of houses heated by oil, which is now selling at more than $4 a gallon. This is really sapping the economy here, and it's kind of, the word crisis is overused, but this is a bad situation. I think, frankly, it's similar in some ways to the conditions that existed in Fairbanks in the 1940s when the municipal utilities system was created.
In response to a similar problems with electricity, I gather, cost of electricity.
Yeah, it was through inadequate electricity supply, unsanitary conditions, and wells, you know, drilled throughout the city, and just septic tanks.
We're out of a supply of time. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.